This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This week we're talking to Daniel Playstead. This episode is being recorded February 3rd, 2010, and we're going to be talking about software testing. Daniel is a software tester on the MEF team at Microsoft. So Daniel, to start things off, can you tell us just generally how testing works in your team?
Yeah, at Microsoft, we have three main engineering disciplines. It's the program managers, the developers, and the testers. The simple way to explain is the program managers design what we're going to do, the developers write the code, and the testers test it. On the MEF team, we're perhaps a little bit more progressive, and the developers actually write the unit tests, and so the testers take care of the rest of the testing activities, the kind of integration, all the other types of testing, as well as to review the unit tests that the developers write. There's how we do testing. There's a whole lot I could talk about. I mean, there's kind of the infrastructure, there's kind of the how we figure out what we're going to test, the whole process.
Well, can you start with, like, what sort of, are you using automated testing tools for you know, unit testing, but then also for integration testing? What sort of software tools do you use for that?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So, yes, we use basically a unit testing framework. We kind of use the MS test framework, which is Blend Visual Studio. I think we kind of use that because we use those attributes, but when it actually runs, it's actually a different framework actually running it, so... Anyway, but we use that kind of a system for our unit tests and for our functional tests, which is basically just tests written by the testers in the same style, but not such at a unit level or complicated and stuff. So those are those tests. And then we also have a model-based testing framework where we can build models, kind of like state machines of what can happen. And then we can generate test cases from that. So that's another part of our framework.
Now, is that a custom tool? Is that a custom framework you guys have, or is it?
Yeah, it's an internal framework at Microsoft. It's not written by the MEF team, but we have taken it parts of it as our own, and of course made our own changes and stuff. But model-based testing is an interesting. I found it interesting for MEF. There's been we've used it for a lot of features where it wasn't so much about being model-based, so it wasn't a complicated state machine. It was just basically, well, you have all these parameters for what you want to test, and you want to test all the different combinations of them, or at least some set of the combinations of those parameters. So we end up having a very simple model where there's basically like one start state and then a transition to, you know, any number of end states, but nothing really complicated where you would think like this is more of a state machine. There's only been one area where I've actually had this is actually a complex state machine where it can go here, then it can go back, and depending on whatever.
Yeah, it was interesting. This last weekend was the Northwest Day of Python, Seattle City College, and one of the presenters had written a model-based testing framework in Python, and it just so happened that he was pretty familiar with it because he worked at MS Research. He had left there, and I guess he'd gone to the UW, but he worked on testing things like the Samba protocols for, and he talked about, you know, so being able to write these models out and you know, follow the path all the way through. And I wish I had been more familiar with the concept before the before the presentation, because I'd probably remember more of the terms that he used in terms of you know, following your way through the path to get to the end state, and how that was useful in some situations, but in other situations where you wanted to set up, you know, kind of specific states and look at specific paths that you were interested in, that it didn't really fall down, but it was you had to write a lot of code to get it to do that, and probably more code than you'd have to do if you just wrote a regular integration test at that point. But he said it was great for many things like protocol and framework testing, where you've got a lot of what I called uninteresting kind of states and inputs that you have to check still, kind of for correct.
Yeah. So just first of all, yeah, Python might be in some ways easier. We've got the tool we use is an internal Microsoft tool. I think there's several different of them, but you end up defining the model in this UI where you define the states and then all the inputs and stuff. And then there's this I guess it's a, you call it a DSL for actually defining, well, what are the allowed transitions and how does it change the various states and stuff. So I think it would be a lot easier if it was just in C# or Python or some other language rather than just the specific language for this tool. One thing that it sounded like you might have been touching on is for some models, you end up with, you know, if it's a simple model, there'll be, you know, n number of transitions, you know, 100, 10, 500, and maybe you want to run all of those. But if you have lots of different possible inputs, it may be that, you know, there's millions and there's just no way you can test that. So we have the capability of you know, randomly picking some tests, and you can choose like a how the combinations are going to be. Like pairwise combination would be, you know, you've got, you know, 8 different options, and let's just say each of them are blue. Or so pairwise combination would, for every pair of those, it would test all the combinations of those pairs, but it wouldn't necessarily test all the combinations with any of the other 6 options, if that makes sense. So, and you can expand that to 3Ys and 4Ys or however many you think is necessary to cover it. So that helps you kind of reduce the testing space to a little bit more manageable, but also to kind of understand what it is you're testing, so you have some confidence on the coverage.
So when you do that, you trim it down to a more manageable number of tests, but then do you do some like fuzz testing or something, or random testing on top of that? Or do you later do a more thorough run where you go and test all those kind of states that you weren't expecting?
So probably not, because so as part of our test process, you know, we run test passes every so often. And one thing you could do would be to generate new test cases each time. We don't do that currently. But basically, the idea is that when you are choosing those test cases at random from this massive space, and so if you've got, you know, 4 million test cases, possible test cases in the space, you're probably never going to test all of those. So you're going to just pick some random ones. And, you know, we test. A lot of the models we have around 1,000 or 2,000 test cases. And because of this N-wise combinations, we know that, okay, well, there's all these options, but some of them really probably aren't too related. So if there's most a group of, you know, 4 that we think is the largest group of them that would really have some sort of interesting interaction, then we just do a 4-wise combination. And we'll still get some of the other stuff, so we'll probably get decent coverage there. But we know we have the full coverage over all combinations of 4 of those options.
Now, doing that kind of testing on anything, you know, a financial account controller or something like that could be difficult enough. But for something like MEF, as an extensibility framework, I mean, it just seems like it would be really difficult to define all the different, you know, states and usage and all that kind of stuff. I mean, how do you go about mapping all that out?
Yeah, so that is interesting. So one of the things we do is we kind of break it down. So there's MEF is in kind of like an extensibility / IOC type of thing, you can almost call it. So there's the part of it which is about, you know, hooking up these what we call composable parts, the imports and exports together. And that's kind of like the core composition engine. But there's also basically looking at your classes that you've written and converting that into the primitives layer, which is what defines, well, this is the part, this is the export, and this is the import. So those are two kind of complicated areas, but they're really entirely separate as far as when we want to get deep into testing them. So we have one group of tests that basically tests the conversion of classes and stuff with these MEF attributes on them to our programming model, which is basically just an abstract set of classes where you've got a class for a composable part definition, and then it has import definitions and export definitions on it. So it's all very abstract, and it's not related to the actual attributes you write for imports and exports at all. You could theoretically implement your own programming model that works with Python or that uses a conventional model instead of putting those attributes on. So we have one model that tests basically the programming model converting to the primitives. And then we have another, we actually have several other basically suites tests that test the actual, what we call the composition. So given that we have a part with this type of exports and this type of imports, or a set of parts in some sort of configuration, what will happen? And so those are basically, we think about those in terms of a graph, where, you know, you've got your parts as nodes in the graph, basically, and the imports and exports define the links between them. And so we've got, you know, tests for cycles between those and just trees and other types of interrelated parts. So, for example, probably I'm not sure how much more time we want to spend on the model-based testing, but going back to the programming model testing, the model for that is one of these that I was talking about is not very complicated. It's really just a bunch of options, and we're really just using the tool as a way of saying, well, here's all these possibilities. So I'm going to test basically an export attribute, but it may be applied to a class, it may be applied to a property, it may be applied to a field. The thing it's applied to may be public, private, protected. The type it's applied to may be an object, may be a string, may be a value type. It may have a specified contract name on the attribute, or it may be inferred, those types of things. So we have all those kinds of options, and basically we write a model that includes all those combinations and are basically using this model-based testing tool just to generate those combinations.
Is that run as separate test runs, or is there kind of like a continuous integration type of system where you're able to fire these off every time that there's a code change?
So the model-based tests are not run on check-in currently. It takes longer to run them, and the system just isn't set up. So when we're doing active development, ideally we'll have daily runs. So every night we'll get the results. And we have a check-in verifier system. So basically, instead of checking directly in, we basically submit the change to the computer, which basically, you know, gets the latest code, applies the change, and then runs all the functional tests on it. And if any of them fail, then the check-in will be rejected.
Okay, so we've got, you know, obviously unit tests that are going to catch any immediate bugs. We've got functional tests. Do you then, do those tests also include performance metrics, like, you know, a test is able to run, but takes 1,000 times longer than you think it should?
So we have a separate suite of performance tests and a separate suite of stress tests. Let's see, the performance tests, I can't remember right now. I know that the stress tests are run as part of the functional runs, just to make sure, just for additional coverage. And then I think the perf ones are too. But those are run separately to test the perf and the stress.
Just to clarify for listeners, what's the difference? Performance is, you know, how fast things run, and stress is how well things run under pressure, like when they're memory stress or high use.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, performance is just about how fast it runs. Stresses it for, you know, running it for many hours to see if there's not a memory leak of some kind. It also covers you know, that's as far as running it for many hours, the most common things you want to check for are, is there a memory leak? And then if you have different threads, so if you want to support any kind of multi-threading, then the stress tests will do a bunch of work on different threads and try to expose any threading issues.
So the developers are working with their unit tests, and I'm curious how you guys balance what you do versus what they do. So especially when you're talking about API level stuff. You know, are you looking at what their unit tests do and then kind of fill in the blanks or cover things that you think they're not hitting? Or like, what's the negotiation between what you're covering and what they're covering?
Well, yes, ideally we would all have a clear idea of, you know, what's a unit test and what's a integration or a tester test, and we just do that. In practice, it's more like we do kind of have an idea, but basically what happens is the dev will write tests, the unit tests as they call them, and we'll also think of, well, what do we want to test? And then we'll kind of look at the intersection, and if they've already covered something, then great. You know, their tests are generally more of a smaller scale unit type tests, and we try to go for the broad coverage, the more complicated scenarios and stuff. So they will, you know, test each method and the different arguments and stuff that it gets. And they'll also try to test some basic cases. For example, going back to the example that I gave of the programming model test, they'll code up a few specific, you know, examples of that and make sure it does the right thing in some specific cases. But it's kind of our responsibility to think about, okay, well, then is it covering everything that it should cover from our end?
And do you guys do app building kinds of exercises, like coming up with different scenarios in which real world scenarios and in which a customer would
yes,
use this
we
thing?
Do. As far as actual app building, we do various samples and apps and stuff. Perhaps it's not quite as much as we could. I guess one thing we kind of do in that vein, which is a little bit new for us at Microsoft, I think at least, is what we call exploratory testing. You're going to have to cut out a lot of ums on my side.
Yeah, that's
anyway,
no problem.
yeah. Okay, starting again. So exploratory testing is basically once the initial code has been checked in, we basically just try to use it. So we try to use it like a user would. We don't worry about having a robust set of automated tests. Just whatever makes the most sense for us to come at it like a customer would, we try to spend half day or day just using that feature. And that generally gives us a good idea of, you know, is this thing completely broken? Does it work well? So it gives us that early feedback on how good the feature is. And that's good because automated testing can take a while. So you end up putting a lot of effort into automating your tests, which gives you long-term benefits, but it also can take a while to do. So you may be on a tight schedule and they checked something in and you really want to know, well, is it going to be ready to ship? So the exploratory testing can give you a good feel for that quickly.
When the worst happened and you find a bug, how closely do you work with the devs to kind of to help them figure out where the bug is? Because I know there's been sometimes, especially with multi-threaded code, where you'll run into situations that you just can't reproduce on your dev machine. It's almost like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Heisenberg.
Yeah, Heisenberg. Anything that you try to do to affect the bug causes it to not happen because, you know, whatever debugger, whatever you have attached slows it down just enough that you don't hit that weird case. So I'm just kind of wondering, what are the kind of things that you guys or girls or testers, let's say, we don't get angry hate mail, how do you work with them? Or do you kind of stay, not standoffish, but more outside of the black box. So you don't want to know, you know, too much of the details of what's going on in the framework or whatever you're testing.
Yeah, we are pretty close to the actual details of how it works. So there's a lot of parts to that question. Just how closely do we work with the devs and stuff? And then as far as multi-threaded or Heisenbugs, if it's just a normal functional bug that's easy to reproduce, you know, we'll either figure out exactly what the problem is ourselves, or at least we'll usually work with a dev to figure it out. You know, if it's threading issue, that's a whole other ball of wax, and that can take a while to track down. But again, we'll usually be working pretty closely with the dev on that. As far as how close we are to the product, our team is kind of flexible, and we actually have a little bit fewer testers than we'd like. So we've had devs write unit tests, we've had devs do the testing for the features, and we've also had program managers do that a little bit to do some testing work to pick up the slack. But we want to make sure that the same person who wrote the feature doesn't test it. So we at least make sure of that, but we're all pretty involved in the design of the product. So basically, when we're designing a feature, we'll have what we call a feature crew, which is a PM, a program manager, a dev, and a tester. And they'll work on the design of it together. So the tester will be responsible for testing that, but he'll have a pretty good idea of how it's supposed to work and some idea, in most cases, of how it's implemented.
When you're talking about the Heisenbug thing, I know that there's some features like in Visual Studio 2010 and as far as testing and working with visual machines and, you know, testing lab setup in which you can preserve the running state of the machine and all that. Is that something that you're able to use, or is that still kind of too far off as far as your team, how your team's set up?
Well, I don't believe we're using the specific tools that Visual Studio has for that. Well, I guess basically if the process crashes, then we get a dump of that and you can load that up and see the stack trace and hopefully get an idea of what was going on. So that's kind of what we have at our disposal for doing that.
So Meth is one of the new breed of projects coming out of Microsoft that is open source, quote unquote, MSPL licensed. I'm wondering if that does that affect you guys in the sense of, you know, is people are not just using the code, but people are now looking at the code. And do you guys, you know, look at the product from that perspective and actually, you know, review the code as an open source user might? Or, you know, are there other things that you do differently because you're QAing an open source project, you know, MSPL project?
I don't think so. Personally, I don't think I do. We are open sourcing it mainly, well, for a lot of reasons, but the main effect that I see that it has on the product is so that we can get early feedback and so that we can engage with the community and they can tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and hopefully we can adjust that before we release. So it's not just this something that we've developed behind closed doors and then we release it and it's up to you to take it or leave it. There's certainly, you know, it's open source, but so is really most of the .NET framework. You can look at the source code too. It's not open source in the sense that you can compile it for yourself, but you can view the source and debug most of the .NET framework. So, yeah, we're not perfect at all, and people can see that. But I think on the whole, they're happy to have that access, happy to be able to tweak it to their needs, especially before we release it. So I don't see, I don't feel much pressure because it's open source, for example.
Do you end up getting any kind of bug reports or input from the community that your testing team wouldn't have seen otherwise?
There's been at least a few bugs that the community has found. we also get a lot of feedback on feature requests and you know, how can I do this? So as far as bugs, it's helpful, but again, it's mostly the feedback on the design that's really the most valuable.
Is K Scott awake? That's just my question.
Oh, yes, I am. Sorry, I'm just a bit under the weather, though. But I was curious what the most challenging part of this would be. I just think it would be gnarly to test conditions where this assembly should have been loaded and this assembly should not have been loaded and probably have to throw app domains away and everything. Is this, what was the challenge, and is it all done using managed code or...?
Yeah, that is actually something I had to deal with. It was all done using managed code. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that was interesting. I wouldn't say that was the biggest challenge, I think, is dealing with more mundane and less interesting things. But as far as that specific thing goes, that we have, for VS at least, we have catalog caching. You can know what parts are in assembly without actually having loaded it if the results of inspecting that have been cached from a previous run. So it was like, well, if the assembly has changed, then it should be loaded. You should check that assembly has been loaded into memory and that the parts have been correctly updated. If it hasn't changed since you last cached it, then it shouldn't be loaded, but you should still be able to inspect everything. But the moment you try to create some from it, then it should be loaded. So yeah, I had to basically do everything in a separate app domain. The controlling logic would be the main app domain, and then anytime you want to actually interact with the cache or whatever, you have to create a separate app domain. And that was actually the test that I thought that the model-based testing was really a good fit for, because the cache has basically different states. You know, is it up to date? What are the contents of the thing that's being cached? So that was interesting. I enjoyed that. But the challenges that we face are not as interesting, I think, or the things I'm currently dealing with is just infrastructure stuff, you know, running, trying to get a machine set up to test correctly for all different environments and stuff like that.
So that's one of the interesting things that affects me as a developer is, you know, getting the everything set up. And, you know, it's weird because, you know, you kind of can get into these rat holes when you're trying to, even just writing unit tests, but even when you're working, when I've worked with QA people in the past and testers, and we've kind of you know, tried to set up the environment to see what would happen. You're always trying to straddle the line between, okay, we need a clean machine so that we can see how everything's working. Then you also wonder if you shouldn't, you know, run it in some crazy environment, you know, where you've got all three frameworks installed, the machine, you know, and I'm wondering if you run into situations where you have to test it in one configuration, then test it in another configuration with a hotfix applied maybe to the OS, or how far down you have to go. Like, you don't have to test, like, the actual Fusion stuff, and this is maybe a little naive because I don't really know how MEF works. It's all the magic cloud of MEF to me. But, you know, if you have to, just how far down you have to test, and kind of when you find a bug, do you just log it into the big bug, you know, basket, and whichever team is responsible for it kind of susses it out and fixes it? Or do you know, like, okay, I have to go tell, you know, Donna that this is, you know, her bug and her component? Or, you know, how does all that kind of, that's interesting.
Okay, so let's see.
I know there's a whole lot of junk in that question, isn't there? So let's start.
Yes,
with,
there
know,
is.
How do you decide to set up the environment? Let's start from there, and we'll work from.
Okay.
Work our way through the mess.
So generally, there's two ways that tests can be run. I mean, it can be on a machine that you're developing on, and those it's with Mac. We don't expect there to be many platform-specific bugs. So, you know, we think that you shouldn't have to worry too much about the environment of the machine. But we need to verify that. So we basically have a whole bunch of configurations that we need to test on, and that's handled by lots of infrastructure that we have as a division, I guess. So, you know, before the release, at each milestone of the release, there'll be a test pass, and there'll be, you know, these configurations that you need to test on, and it'll be combinations of different OSs, of different processors, of different languages for the OSs, of, you know, it's a .NET framework, so did they install it clean, or was it an upgrade from a previous version? So we have this big matrix, and depending on the test pass, there may be, for a small one, there might be just five, you know, but it can be up to anywhere to 30 to 50, I think, different configurations that you have to run this on. So obviously we don't want to set each machine up manually, so we have a program called Mad Dog, which kind of manages that, where you can basically kick off a run, and it has settings for all of these different options, so what OS it is and all of these options, and it will basically, you know, point the machine, install Windows on it, install the software you've selected on it, and then kick off your tests on that machine and report the results. So it's pretty nice. It's also a very complex system, so that's where some of the hassle comes in from. But it's certainly there's a way we could do it, or that I want to do it, without having some sort of automation on that. So that kind of covers the, you know, what platforms do you test on, and how do you, as far as how you know what should be in that matrix, it's usually it's not just limited to a given team or whatever. So you can pool the knowledge of people across the division, I guess, and they have expertise knowing, you know, well, these are the things that are likely to cause issues. So they can choose the configuration matrix pretty well. So I think that covers part of the question. Any further questions on that part, or should I move on?
No, I think that's okay. And then kind of, you know, how far down are you responsible for? You know, do you just look at system.whatever? Or if, you know, you see other bugs come up, how do those filter their way back to the correct teams?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, we're responsible mainly for testing MEF. So if we're, for example, relying on assembly.load, which we are, then we shouldn't really have to test that assembly.load works correctly. Now, we may want a little bit of testing because the developer might have written assembly.load from instead of assembly.load, and so that may change some things. So we shouldn't need to test that assembly.load and load from work correctly, but we may need some level of testing to make sure that the developer called the right one, for example. That said, we may find bugs that are lower down the framework just incidentally, and when we do, basically, well, since I was new to Microsoft, I mean, I didn't know who to file them to. So I'd ask my manager and he'd basically know, well, this is this area, assign it to this guy. So we have a bug database basically, and you can assign the bug to a person, a team basically, and then they'll look at it and investigate it. So I found a couple bugs, and if it's not on team, it's a little bit more difficult because you need to be able to show how to reproduce the bug, but the other team probably isn't using the same environment or anything. They're not using the same test infrastructure necessarily. So you need to come up with basically a standalone program that doesn't use MEF, but that demonstrates the bug.
I'm sure that as you're testing things, that there are specific coding practices that developers write, especially in framework development, that make code easier to test, both unit and then at a larger scale. Are there things specific to your team that are effective? And then I'm also trying to think as we, you know, to developers that are listening, how they can apply this, if there's things that you think in general developers can do in writing code to make it better, not just for unit testing, but for broader testing.
Yeah. So in some ways, I think MEF testing is easier in that respect because we're just a library. So all of the testing, it's pretty much just interacting with the API. So there can be a lot of different possibilities there, but you don't have to worry about UI testing. You don't have to worry about a lot of external factors like that, and you don't have to worry about, you know, the network. So all of these things that can complicate the testing, a lot of them don't apply to MEF, although on Silverlight, the network is starting to.
But you don't have to deal with localization much either, do you?
Yeah, that's another thing that's easier. I mean, but not much, because it's basically just the exception string, and that's pretty easy to verify.
You guys have it easy. No UI hooks, not much localization. This is like the tester's dream job, huh?
Yeah, really. I mean, in some sense, it's like, you know, we've got it easy in some sense.
Is this where they send the veterans of like Vista and Win7 UI testing launches? Say, here, go work on the framework for a few months and you know, so you don't get burnt out and calm down. It's kind of like kind of like a furlough. Here,
might be a good idea, but no. Yeah, as far as that goes, I mean, they do obviously take breaks after a major release, and some of that is to focus on infrastructure and stuff. So that could kind of serve as the same thing. Going back to, you know, how do you make sure that it's possible to test? I mean, I guess ensuring that you can test pieces of of whatever it is you're testing, of the application or the library, without testing the whole thing, is one thing that would be helpful. And so I guess that's the decoupling buzzword, which kind of gets into the whole IOC thing, which MEF is kind of related to.
Is that asking for a question there?
No, not really. I mean, it's just the history of MEF as far as IOC is interesting. And basically when we started out, we wanted to not say that it was an IOC container because that's not its purpose, and we don't want people who prefer other IOC containers, which may be definitely better for their purposes, to be forced to use MEF for what it's really not designed for because it comes from Microsoft. So we kept saying that, you know, it's not an IOC, it's for different, and that's true partly, but, you know, it really is similar in some ways, and so some people do use it that way. So that was kind of just referring to that.
Sure, sure.
That history.
Yep.
And Hamilton Oliveira, who wrote the Windsor, is on our team now. And he's basically said, you know, well, by now he's like, well, people figured it out that it kind of is an IOC container. So we should just let them call it that if they want.
Yeah. Scott Kay had sent an article about from the Google testing blog. Do you want to ask about that, or do you think we've already kind of covered some of that?
Yeah, it was mostly talking about interviewing and how you can kind of tell what kind of a tester someone's going to be just by the way that they decide to break down the problem. So, you know, if they try and break it down into features, you know, and try to get it to the smallest possible unit of work and kind of do that for all the features on something. You know, he called that the divide and conquer kind of framework. He'd said the pessimist framework starts looking for the thing that they think will break it first, you know. So yeah, they're the ones that first try a buffer overflow, or if it says, you know, it takes an int, you know, they try every, you know, they try the boundaries of int and, you know, see what happens. And there are some other other things in there. The storybook, you know, kind of says it's where you look at it and develop these scenario paths, and that's what you test. We covered a little bit of that, kind of how do you look at something like MEF and where do you start testing, I think, early on, and that kind of covers some of it.
Yeah, the interesting thing when I read that is I couldn't figure out what bucket I should be in, so I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. But
so you described your team as a progressive team, as you called it, you know, where the developers were doing a lot of unit testing and you guys are adding on to that. Do you see that approach spreading to other teams in Microsoft? Is that gaining some traction in other parts of the organization?
I think so. I don't know specifically which teams would be doing it or not, but definitely I think in our organization, so in .NET and Visual Studio, it seems to me like it is gaining traction.
Yay. Because I look at what, you know, the way that the MVC team and the way that the MEF team have gone about this. You know, I don't know how long they worked on MEF before they posted it, but it seemed like it was pretty soon.
I think it was pretty soon.
Yes.
Well,
it didn't incubate for a couple of years before they put it up on CodePlex. I don't think. It seemed like they got out there pretty quick and started getting feedback on it, and people really got excited by that fact. And you know, and the same with the MVC team. You know, it seems like Scott Koo kind of prototyped it worked on it on the way to present it in Austin that one time. You know, it's kind of when people got to see it for the first time. And I think that despite the fact, you know, some people look at it and think, well, it doesn't do this yet, so it's crap. I still think that, at least from the outside, it's a much better process than, you know, forcing the team to kind of sit there and guess and maybe bring in some focus groups for, you know, NDA looks at it, getting a very narrow perspective on what might work and what wouldn't. And plus doing it this way, the Mono team didn't beat you guys to shipping. So kudos for that.
Well, I think that Mono is actually going to ship MEF. I believe that's what I heard. Basically just take our source code because that's what the license allows. I personally, and I mean, I think it's a general opinion. I mean, developers kind of like being open, like getting that feedback. I think that sometimes for business reasons, you know, the company may not want to do that. You know, fortunately, MEF and MVC were projects that I felt it would work well for. So, and I think that's just generally the way it's going. So hopefully it'll just keep increasing. But I felt really lucky to land on the MEF team. You know, we were engaging with a community like that. We had a bunch of famous, you could say, people join the team and on the team. So I was just really happy.
So speaking of joining the team and just kind of, I'm curious how you went into software testing. It's something, you know, it's definitely a different kind of skill, but it's intensely technical and highly related to what we're doing, you know, as you know, general software developers. So I just wondered how, you know, what, mm-hmm. how you found yourself where you're at now.
Yeah. So I was working at a small development shop in Atlanta, and I wanted to work for Microsoft kind of for a while, but just didn't. Microsoft has, you know, thousands of jobs, often it does, and it's just, they have these descriptions that really don't tell you much about it. So I never really knew if that would be a good fit for me. I really probably wanted to work on .NET or Visual Studio or something. And so finally there was a post on Brad Amesroom's blog, I think it was, about they were hiring. And so that's how I ended up applying and getting the job. It wasn't, I didn't apply specifically to be a tester. I applied to several of the positions they were offering and interviewed for a tester position and was hired. So that's when I became a tester. And that was only a year and a half ago. So I'm certainly not an expert by any means. But I enjoy it and I'm learning. I think the first step to being good at something is realizing that you're not and that you never will be. You can always improve, I guess.
Yeah.
To what extent do the different test teams in Microsoft coordinate, strategize, you know, sort of cross educate each other, you know, sort of work at a come together at a higher level and you know, trade techniques and learnings and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, there's a lot of that, or well, I don't know if it's a lot, but yes, we do that. There's there's basically brown bags and meetings where people will present, you know, a particular testing technology or a best practice or something like that. And then there's, you know, there's people looking at, well, how do we test in general? And how can we, across the company or across the division or whatever, how can we improve how we test? A lot of what that ends up being is, you know, well, are we duplicating work across all these teams with the infrastructure? I mean, would it not make sense to have a common infrastructure so we wouldn't have to redo the work? And that is kind of a challenging problem because when you try to do that, it turns out that each team has different needs and, you know, maybe it doesn't work out as well as you hope. So that's a hard problem, but we definitely do that and are always trying to improve on that. But as far as learning from each other, I'd say the main thing that we end up doing is, you know, we'll, if someone's doing something that's worth knowing about, then they'll give a presentation either to a specific team or to kind of like a, just a general, whoever's interested can come and learn. One thing, just continuing on the previous thing I was talking about, one interesting presentation was about something called synchronization coverage. So this was, code coverage is obviously, you know, do your tests run each line of code in the product? And so that kind of gives you some level of confidence that the product is covered. It at least tells you that if you have a low code coverage, that you aren't testing adequately. If you have a high code coverage, well, maybe you're testing adequately, maybe you're not. So it can help a little bit. So the presentation was on synchronization coverage, where the idea is with multi-threaded apps, you want to look at the lock statements because that's where a lot of multi-threading issues can be. And it's not just enough to run that piece of code that is locking. You want to test when there's contention for the lock. So if you're trying to access a resource and you have a lock statement about it, but in your stress test where you're supposed to be testing this multi-threaded, it's always just granted immediately and there's never something else using it, then you're probably not fully testing the multi-threaded side of your code. So they showed that. They gave some, you know, showed a prototype of how they're using that. And I think it was a parallel framework that ended up using this and actually found a good deal of bugs. So they were able to fix them because of that.
All right. Should I wrap up here?
Sounds like it.
Okay. So, Daniel, is there anything you'd like to, you know, point our listeners to? Anything that if they'd like to know more or any you know, personal things that you'd like to, you know, things you're selling or speaking or anything like that?
Not really. I'm happy to talk to people if they're interested or whatever. I'm on Twitter or I have a blog, which I very rarely post to, but always open to interacting with people who are interested. And as far as meth goes, JMeth, use it. I don't know.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll make sure to put the links to your blog and Twitter in the show notes. Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks a bunch for talking to us this week. And that's all the time we have this week. We'll catch you next week on Herding Code. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Thanks a lot, guys. That was fun.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.